The issue of election integrity, balancing voter rights with fair elections. Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap is in the eye of the storm when it comes to the debate over voter fraud. Dunlap is one of four Democrats serving on the President's Commission on Election Integrity. Twice now, Dunlap has refused to hand over data about Maine voters that was requested by the head of the commission, saying to do so would be illegal. The commission was formed by the president after he repeatedly alleged widespread voter fraud during the campaign. But many others say it is a non-issue whipped up to justify voter suppression efforts. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with Dunlap about the president's commission, and we'll put today's controversy into historical perspective with two professors who study voting rights. What are your questions about election integrity? Maine Calling is next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In the aftermath of last year's presidential election, Donald Trump claimed there was widespread voter fraud and that it cost him winning the popular vote. The president established an advisory commission on election integrity to look into whether there is widespread voter fraud. Most voting rights experts say voter fraud is a non-issue. Today, we're going to hear from a member of the advisory commission and two professors who study voting issues. In the studio with me today, in our Augusta studio, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap. He serves on the Presidential Advisory Commission on Voting Integrity. He has refused to turn over Maine voting information to the commission, not once, but twice. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Amy Freed. She is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine. And also in our Bangor studio, David House. He's associate professor of history at Husson University. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And as always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about voter fraud and voting rights? Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you.
Well, thank you for having us. Welcome. All.
Thank.
Great to be here.
Matt, you have gone on the record and said that you don't believe voter fraud is an issue, either here in Maine or around the country. And when you were first appointed to this commission, this presidential commission, people urged you not to do it. And then once you joined it, people urged you to resign. Why are you still there?
Well, I think we have an awful lot to be proud of in this state and in this country about the way we conduct elections. And on election night, often I'm on public radio or on TV talking about how the election's going and turnout and that sort of thing. And it always goes really, really well. And it's not really necessarily because of anything I'm doing. It's because we have 503 towns staffed by town clerks, registrars of voters, ballot clerks, most of them volunteers, who really, truly care about the process, and they do an excellent job administering it. So we have so few issues in the conduct of elections that we haven't sent an allegation of wrongdoing to the Attorney General's office maybe more than twice in the last dozen or so years that I've been in or around the office of Secretary of State. So, you know, when I was asked to be a part of the commission, you know, I told the folks, first of all, I'm busy and I'm not looking for extra work, but, you know, depending on what the workload was and what my staff had to say about it, we may or may not be interested. And our elections folks were like, basically they said, if we have an opportunity to tell our story, we should be there to tell it. And so I agreed to be a part of it. And I think now in the fullness of time, I think it's more important than ever that I'm there. We've had one meeting, and I think there are some preconceived notions about, you know, what happens in elections. But what we find is when there's a question about something that's happened, you know, a head scratcher, if you will, typically what it is somebody that they've made a mistake, they're confused, they don't know what they're doing. Either the election official or the voter, but it's never malevolent. And I've said right along, I don't think we're going to find very much on this commission, but I think it's important to have this discussion because it's sort of taken on this urban legend dynamic, if you will, about the pervasiveness of voter fraud. And if you remember when we were kids, you know, trick-or-treating was one of those things where you never took wrapped candy that was made at somebody's house. You never took brownies. You never took Rice Krispie treats. Only packaged candy. I think it was a conspiracy of the candy factories, because the legend there was the razor blades. You remember the razor blades?
I do.
You know, I've never heard of anybody biting into a razor blade, but everybody knew that was out there somewhere. It was that dark force, if you will. And I think if we can go through these discussions and look at the actual factual evidence, I think we will finally answer this question about the pervasiveness of voter fraud, and I think we'll be able to move that aside and talk about what we do right in our elections process.
Matt, as I mentioned at the top of the program, twice now you've refused to turn over the voter records that the commission you serve on has requested. Why are you not turning these over? After all, political campaigns and others can get a hold of these records if they pay a really relatively minor fee.
Well, and this is actually pretty simple. This is a matter of law. And you know, I sat down with our Attorney General, Janet Mills, and I said, let's look at this together and see if you see the same thing I see. And she said, you're absolutely right. The issue is, yes, political campaigns, issue campaigns, parties, candidates can access the voter list. Even educational institutions or government institutions doing research can access the voter file, if not for very little, then for free. But the key element is it has to be kept confidential. So a political party under the law can take the voter file, make it available to its candidates. But those candidates are under the same yoke of
But didn't Kobach say he was going to keep it confidential?
The initial request came and they said, be aware that anything you submit to the commission will be part of a public record. So we said we can't do that. The follow-up request that came after a U.S. district court struck at least one of the challenges to the commission's request for the voter data of all the states said, well, we are going to keep it private. And you know, now my question is, under what authority does the commission have to make a public record a non-public record? So, but deeper than that, and I said this in my response to the commission, that we need to understand better what we're looking for. And as you know, the professors on the show with us will probably attest, the first rule of research is know what you're looking for. Getting the vast voter files of very high-level information doesn't tell you very much. I suggest that we look at how jurisdictions handle the head-scratchers. You know, what is the policy? What is the procedure? What are the administrative actions you take? What works best? What doesn't work so well? And I think that's where we can actually maybe focus some productive work.
David House, put this in historical perspective. Has voter fraud bubbled to the top of the national conversation before?
It has at different times. We were in studio talking before the show came on a little bit. Classically, Lyndon Johnson won his first election by raising the dead in a great way. His nickname became Landslide Lyndon. In 1960, there were a number of rumors about John Kennedy mobilizing the vote in West Virginia in a variety of rather suspect ways. And there were certainly concerns around the returns from the city of Chicago in the general election in 1960. So there have been concerns before about voter fraud. And in this case, I'd like the comment that you had made earlier. I'd like you to add to this, if you could.
That's to me, Amy, yeah. Amy Fried here, that what we really see in those kinds of cases is not really voter fraud. It's voting fraud. It's activities by campaigns or by political parties. It's the idea that citizens just, you know, or non-citizens just show up and vote when they're not entitled to vote, you know, in person. Voter fraud, that simply does not happen.
So and, historically, you know, I'd Amy, go, I'm sorry, ballots, stuffing the ballot boxes is more common if we look back in history than somebody misrepresenting themselves at the poll.
Yes.
Absolutely. And, you know, to a point that Matt made about myths about fraud or, you know, whatever Halloween and mistakes. I mean, one of the big studies that gets cited by people who say there's a lot of voter fraud and it's the source of this, you know, purported whatever millions of, you know, illegal immigrant voters has, you know, that it turns out that the numbers are for supposedly 14% of immigrants voting illegally are just mistaken. It's measurement error. You know, there were 19,000 people who were interviewed several times, and, you know, it turns out that people just sort of checked the wrong box who said that they voted and that they were also non-citizens. I mean, this has been looked at very carefully. So, you know, but then that has been the source of a great deal of political rhetoric claiming that voter fraud is extensive.
And
Matt
Dunlap,
go ahead, David.
I was just going to say, before we developed the secret ballot and those reforms historically, it was a lot more common to see different techniques to mobilize the vote. So parties would employ individuals to get people to the polls and make sure they vote. Parties pre-printed tickets and a number of these techniques. In the South, notably, there were a variety of techniques to disenfranchise voters that were used, anything from what were called eight-box ballots to literacy tests, which proliferated in a number of states, North and South. So you do see a number of attempts to affect the outcome of elections or change, and also at the same time disenfranchise some voters and change the count. So that's been more of a problem historically than I'd say we have any evidence for now.
I want to look at another angle of this. There was a news article out just last week. I'm citing the headline from the Associated Press. Matt Dunlap, you're quoted in this. The article is, "Trump's Voter Fraud Commission could create a target for hackers," critics say. What is your concern?
Well, this is, in terms of the issue of hacking, this more gets into election systems. And we are a little bit more immune to that than many other jurisdictions, simply because we use paper ballots and it's almost an entirely paper-based system, with the exception of the central voter registration system, which is housed here in Augusta. Every town clerk has access to their section of it. And one of the frustrations here as an election official, when you have the FBI and Homeland Security prior to the election talking about the dangers to our election systems without really knowing what it was they were talking about. You can't hack a paper ballot, for example. When we took the whole thing apart and laid it out on the table, we realized that, you know, we could have our voter file completely destroyed. And we could still have an election on election day because of the redundant systems that we have. Now, what we did to safeguard against that was we put in better firewalls and we had protocols for backing things up with clerks so they'd be able to have an incoming voter list on election day. The danger to the hacking stories is erosion of public confidence in the system. So if people – you take an election like we had this last year, which was pretty complicated. You had the presidential race where polls suggested that people didn't like either one of the major party candidates. You had the five citizen initiatives, which were very sophisticated, very involved. And people feel that pull. They want to be involved. And what I find is that citizens want to do the right thing. They take their role as citizen legislators very seriously. But you have all these confusing issues. You say, well, you know, the election's in jeopardy because the technology could be hacked. You've almost given them an excuse to not participate. And what we found in the turnout of the election is that far fewer people voted for president of the United States in the state of Maine than voted in the rest of the ballot. So people left that race blank. And, you know, that's not uncommon, but it was something that really caught our attention this year. So the discussion around hacking, I think, is very destructive, because unless you understand what that is happening to the technology, what the risks are, you're just discouraging people from participating in the process.
And David, I know this is something you're watching carefully, is the potential erosion of confidence in the system.
Yes, I'd like to echo Secretary of State Dunlap's concern about erosion of public confidence in the system. One of the things that we teach students in government courses is, in the United States, we have four what are called linkage institutions. Right, we have political parties, interest groups, the media, and elections. And these are institutions that tie people and directly connect them to government and the policy process. And my concern is that, as we've seen the conversation, we already have a number of people questioning the integrity of political parties. We have a number of people who question the integrity of interest groups and their role in the policy process. We've certainly seen, especially in the last year, heightened concerns and questions about the integrity of media reports and the factuality of reports, you know, the charges of things like fake news or bad reporting. And my other concern is what happens when you take, I think, the one institution people are generally have generally been confident in and then erode that confidence. And that's very dangerous. And it comes from a number of angles, whether it's, you know, questions about we have people who are voting who shouldn't be, or questions about, you know, the role of hacking in our systems. And while I'd like to agree and say, you know, one of the things that would be a productive conversation is, are there ways we can help states as they use electronic systems or develop better firewalls and those sorts of techniques to protect their data at rest and protect the security of data in motion, and also highlighting the concerns for sort of a national agglomeration of voter data collected in this kind of investigation where it's all housed in one place right now. It could be split up in 50 states. Now, there's a voter information MOU that goes between some states that where they do share data to look for duplicates, but there's a lot of counting concerns or counting error concerns with it. And
sure.
So I think that becomes an issue.
Amy Fried, I want to ask you, and I have to confess, I'm one of those people who in the past thought, boy, the way we vote sure seems old-fashioned. I can do my banking online. I can go do anything having to do with my medical records or history online, but I still drive to the high school and cast my ballot. Is there a better way?
Well, I think there's certainly maybe some better ways to get people registered to vote. There's some states that have automatic voter registration. It would be possible to do something like that nationally. There are plenty of countries that do that, but then we'd have to have some kind of, you know, really universal card or national ID, and I just do not see that happening. If you look at the response in Maine to, you know, the real ID kind of exactly. I mean, it just would not happen. But, I mean, that actually would be something that would make things pretty easy to go from state to state. And you know, I've given talks in other countries sometimes, and people will say, "Well, why don't you have something like that?" And you know, I think a lot of it goes back to this overall distrust in government that, you know, that we've talked about a little bit. You know, which really has long, long historical roots. But I mean, I think making sure that there is electronic backup to or paper backup to this to the systems is really important. I mean, I heard a story just last week on All Things Considered about North Carolina's that they had their poll books where people would show up. These were electronic, and they were told that they had already voted, and there were errors in the electronic system. And it's unclear if this, from what I know, if there was any impact from hacking. But the company that managed the system was a target of Russian hacking. So, you know, and we know that a lot of states were targeted. I've seen different numbers, probably Secretary of State knows the exact number, but I've seen, most recently that over 30 state systems were targeted to be hacked.
Yeah, we heard 21.
All right. Well, guess what? We have to take a break already. When we come back, we'll go to the audience comments and questions. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the law firm of Eaton Peabody. Statewide practice, local service, with offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland.
When white supremacist demonstrators from around the country descended on Charlottesville, Virginia, they had hyped the rally through podcasts and on YouTube.
Never again will we be able to be turned against one another based on regional or ethnic identity, because Europeans stand as one. As one people.
I'm Audie Cornish. Exactly who was uniting in the Unite the Right rally this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear that broadcast beginning at 4 p.m. this afternoon. Do you love public broadcasting? Are you involved with a nonprofit membership organization? As Maine Public Radio, Television, and Online move forward in meeting new goals and providing the best possible listening and viewing experience and value, we're looking for someone to manage our member services team to make it all happen. We have complete details about the position online at mainpublic.org. Just click on About and then Careers, and thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, voting fraud, voting rights, voting suppression. Joining me today in our Augusta studio, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Amy Freed, a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UMaine. Also in our Bangor studio, David House, associate professor of history at Husson University. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Please keep that email brief. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to start with an email from Jean. When I went to the polls to vote in June, I was asked for a photo ID. When I asked why, I was told that I had been, quote, challenged. This incident leaves me with three questions. One, who can challenge a person's right to vote, and what kind of evidence do they need to provide? Two, do I have the right to know why my vote to write was challenged or who challenged it? If so, how do I get the information? And three, having produced my license in June to prove that I am who I say I am and that I'm a legal resident, does this take care of the problem? Or will I have to produce ID again the next time I try to vote? Matt.
Boy, that's a lot. Well, first of all, typically we don't require ID to obtain a ballot in the state of Maine. You do have to present an ID in order to register to vote. The challenge ballot process is sort of an exceptions process, and any citizen can challenge someone at the polls and their eligibility to vote, that they may not be a resident of that area, or they may not be registered to vote, or they may not be who they say they are. And this is all part of a public process, by the way. That's why, you know, you show up at the polls and announce yourself. I don't know the particulars of this particular challenge, but the challenge ballot process usually is involved when somebody is not registered to vote and they don't have any of the backup documents to finalize their registration. So they don't have a photo ID, they don't have a utility bill, they don't have anything to show, you know, that they are qualified voters in that area, and then they are given a ballot with a secret number on it. If there's a recount, that ballot is then segregated, and they do the due diligence, and then they recast the ballot for the recount. Otherwise, after the election, the registrar of voters will then double back with the person and make sure they produce the right materials to show that they are a qualified voter in that area. Something like this, not knowing the reason why the voter was challenged, but yes, people can be challenged, their eligibility to vote in the election. Like I say, it's part of a public process. The final part of that answer is that now that that's been cleared up, there should no longer be an issue. So the challenges can happen at polls. It happens more or less frequently depending on the jurisdiction and the circumstances of the election.
All right. Amy Freed, are we seeing more of this now?
More challenges?
Yes.
I have not really heard about more, that there might be more challenges. They do pop up from time to time. Sometimes I often go over to the polling site at the university, you know, there will be people there who are watching the polls. There have been years when there have been a lot of challenges, but I don't know if there's really a trend in any way.
All right. We'll go to Sophia calling from Orono. Hi, Sophia. Go ahead.
Hi. Wonderful show. Thank you. Our right to vote is just the most important process we have in this country. I am very concerned about Russian hacking or any other foreign entity hacking into our elections, and it seems like maybe going backward. But I noticed that the United Kingdom, when they voted whether to leave the European Union, had hand-counted ballots in a way that I had never seen here. And I know we use, in Maine, paper ballots. That's true, correct? Everywhere, it's not really internet-connected for the vote, per se. But I am concerned about the registration rolls. My daughter was denied a vote in Palm Beach County, Florida, after registering, and several of her friends were also, and which makes me think that probably was one of the states that Russia hacked. And I just wondered about the voter registration rolls. It sounds like we have a pretty good system here in Maine, but what about across the country? Can we trust a national election if these voter registration rolls can be hacked?
Well, about two-thirds of the states do it the way that Maine does it. With, you know, we do have an electronic voter registration system. We print out those lists prior to the election, and that's what the local ballot clerks use to check your name off when you announce yourself at the polls. The ballots are all paper. The tabulating machines that we use just read the ballots, and you always have those paper ballots. It's a question of, about a recount. We have about 200 and I'd say 40 towns that are still hand count. The others are use machine tabulators, but again, all revolving around the paper ballot. I think the real risk and I go back to what I said earlier about the Russian hacking story. They didn't change the results of any elections. We're pretty certain of that. But what they has been very successful at is getting people questioning the entire process and whether or not it's been corrupted by, you know, nefarious agents of the Russian military, you know, sitting in a basement somewhere trying to attack our systems. And we do know that there have been many probes of election databases. I was talking with the Secretary of State from Vermont yesterday, and he was saying that they, in the run-up to the election, their database had been probed about 50,000 times a day by an outside force. But the systems are firewalled and they're built to withstand that type of attack. So, you know, what we're trying to do now is ascertain in a more open dialogue with the federal government and the intelligence bureaus what has been happening with some of these attempts and how do we work together to prevent it in the future. Because right now they haven't been telling us very, very much. We know that 21 states allegedly went through these attacks. We don't know which states those were, and we don't know the degree of the attacks because this has all been confidential information. Working through the National Association of Secretaries of State, we are now working on getting security clearances so we can better understand what's been happening. But I think right now, certainly in the state of Maine, we don't really have very much to worry about from the Russians.
Sophia, thanks so much for your call. We have an email from Todd. Paraphrasing here, the idea of voter fraud having any influence in this or any other election redlines my bullcrud meter. I am not a Trump supporter, but he won fair and square, according to the ballot box. This does not mean he may be removed from office for other reasons, including the Russian probe, but even discussing the subject of voter fraud on the radio gives it too much validity. Dave, do you agree? Is having this discussion giving something validity that doesn't have validity?
I can see the fear of our caller or our emailer, but at the same time, I think the context of our discussion is a little different. I'd say some of my concerns come when the assumption is automatic that voter fraud exists in some widespread way. I think what we're trying to do is very frankly talk to people in Maine a little bit about there may be questions that have been introduced in their mind, and talking very frankly about the security of our system. What evidence do we have of voter fraud or hacking, and why that some of these things may be done and some of the risks posed by the larger discussion. I don't think it's necessarily bad to have this kind of discussion where we can open up and talk about these concerns. I think where it becomes dangerous is when we start to assume that, you know, start with an assumption or conclusion that voter hacking is happening. Voter fraud is happening in widespread numbers. Now, tell me why I'm right.
I'd also jump in here and just say, when I think of a question like the one from Orono about Florida in particular, there are so many other issues in a place like Florida over the years. There's felon disenfranchisement, which then is very difficult to get your vote restored after serving that. That cuts out a lot of people. Palm Beach County, which was mentioned, was where the butterfly ballot was in 2000, which studies have shown, you know, by political scientists, peer-reviewed research, that did have an impact and caused more votes for Pat Buchanan than Al Gore. Probably changed the, you know, it seems like that changed the course of the Florida electoral votes and therefore the entire election. And you have voter ID being used in a way that reduces and suppresses the vote and also attempts to make it harder for people to go out and register people at the polls through their laws, and also changes in early voting. I mean, there's a whole slew of issues that are related to voting besides voting fraud that have the, you know, that are on the side of suppressing the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that this commission opens up that kind of broader conversation, I think that is helpful.
All right. We'll go to Bob, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much for taking my question. I'm going to ask my question, and then I'll take the answer off the air. But when it comes to having a photo ID in order to vote, I kind of equate the fee to obtain a state ID or the fee to obtain a driver's license in order to vote. Wouldn't that equate to a poll tax, which is against one of our constitutional amendments?
Bob, thanks for the question. I'm going to throw that up to our professors in Bangor. Is requiring a voter ID that one needs to pay for, whether it's a driver's license or another kind of ID, a poll tax?
You can make that claim, and that is one of the stricter interpretations of it. Now, the courts have weighed down, saying that states can throw up smaller barriers in order to protect what they say is the integrity of voting, and that's been more recent. But basically, there is a concern that especially because it has an effect to disenfranchise people who are poor and maybe people who are elderly or on fixed incomes, that these can present some financial challenge that stands in the way between them and their right to vote. And so that becomes certainly that has been a question historically.
Yeah, I think one of the things that hasn't really been fully tested out on this is, you know, how narrow can you make that statute about a photo ID in order to obtain a ballot and not cross that line? So if you're specifying, say, the real ID, that you need to have a real ID in order to vote, you know, analysis has shown that if you narrowed it to that one document where you have to get a copy of your certified birth certificate, go through facial recognition screening, a whole bunch of background screening in order to obtain. So if your grandmother's in a nursing home, she's probably not going to vote. Or if you are a migrant worker, you're probably not going to vote. That's been believed to be to cross that threshold and be the equivalent of a poll tax, which would have the other negative consequence for those of people working here in Augusta, that if you couldn't charge for the driver's license, well, now you have a big hole to fill in the highway fund, which they use to fix roads and bridges, and that's paid for in no small part to license fees. So I think that the whole issue of what would constitute a poll tax and a photo ID has to be preceded by what it is you're trying to achieve. And, like I say, we already have photo ID to register. We don't ask for that at the polls because if you forgot your wallet at home and you went to renew your driver's license, you can come back tomorrow. There's only one election day, and with polls close at 8 o'clock and somebody forgets their driver's license or their ID card, that becomes a big problem. They may not be able to participate in the process, and the legislature has demurred on that over the years.
Amy Fried, there are other forms of voter suppression that don't come to mind as easily as saying only people with driver's license might be able to vote. That's easy for people to figure out. Well, people who don't have driver's license, would they then not be able to vote? But there are some other things that you're studying. Tell us other forms of voter suppression.
Well, when it comes to people showing up to vote, I mean, if it's, as I said before, if it's just very difficult to register to vote, that is a problem. It does also make a difference that Maine has same-day voter registration. There's clear research that has an impact, that people are more likely to vote. You have higher turnout in states where you don't have where you don't have to have registered ahead of time. And, of course, we just went through, well, not just, but back in five, six years ago, I guess it was back in 2011, the legislature had put in that, to get rid of same-day voter registration, and there was a people's veto that restored it with a really, really strong vote, a really strong I believe it was a 20-point margin to restore it. So there was, bipartisan support.
I think, yeah. Another aspect of voter suppression, I mean, the dark side of getting out the vote is you're getting out your vote. You're not getting out your opponent's vote. And that's where some of the hijinks come into play. Like this past election cycle in both the University of Maine and at Bates College, at Bates there were flyers that were put on windshields saying that if you come from out of state and you register to vote in Maine, you're going to have to change your vehicle registration, get a Maine driver's license, pay excise taxes. At the University of Maine, it came out as an email saying that out-of-state students who registered to vote here were going to lose their financial aid packages.
During 2011, during that whole campaign about, same-day voter registration, there were letters sent to students saying that, if they didn't have their driver's license in Maine, they should just, unregister to vote.
And weighing in here is an emailer, Eric. I think voter suppression is a bigger issue than voter fraud. He says in Texas, the polling locations were reduced from several thousand to under 900. Most people can't wait in line for 4 to 6 hours to vote and leave, so do not vote. Suppression accomplished. We do have to go to another short break, but first a note about tomorrow's Maine Calling. We are going to talk TV. Many people believe we are living in a golden era of television. My guests tomorrow are the authors of a book about the greatest TV shows of all time, and here's a little preview. They rank The Simpsons as the greatest show. Share your thoughts on TV worth watching at talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us on go to our Facebook page. That's tomorrow on Maine Calling, and we will be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. Maine Public is teaming up with Darlings and Literacy Volunteers of Bangor to share the joy of reading with children across Maine. Many Maine children have limited access to appropriate books, so Maine Public is collecting new books and pristine used books at Darlings and at Maine Public locations. These books will be distributed at many of the Darlings Ice Cream for a Cause stops and also at our upcoming special literacy event. That's this Thursday from 11 until 2 at Maine Public Studio in Bangor at 65 Texas Avenue. The event will include guests reading to the kids, photo opportunities with Clifford the Big Red Dog, and the Darlings Ice Cream for a Cause truck and other fun activities. For more information and all the details, including how to donate books, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events. A reminder to stay tuned this afternoon at 2 p.m. for the World Affairs Council. Today's topic, artificial intelligence and open data. That's at 2 p.m. today.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, questions of voter fraud, voter suppression, and voting rights. Joining me in our Augusta studio, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Amy Freed, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UMaine. Also in our Bangor studio, David House, associate professor of history at Husson University. If you'd like to join a conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll head to Dixmont with David. Hi, David. Go ahead.
First, I want to say thank you to Matt for hanging in there on this commission. As he said when he took the appointment, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So I'm glad that he's hanging in there. You broached this since between the time I called and the time I went on the air a little bit, but a lot of this voter suppression is, in fact, government, main, U.S. government, our government voter suppression. We took your name off the list because there was some felon in the next county that had the same name. We all of a sudden 100,000 voters fell off the list in Brooklyn during the primary. We've reduced the number of voting places, but only in the Democratic urban districts, not in the Republican suburban districts. So and then of course there's gerrymandering, which is the biggest felony of them all. If people want to comment on that, we need to be not worrying as much about the Russians, I think, but what's going on in our own legislature. Thankfully, we do a good job here, but in some of these other states, there's these sort of nameless election commissions that that are making these rules, and I think there's a problem there, and that should be addressed.
Well, I think, you know, when you look at – this is one of the things I think people sometimes don't understand about the electoral process is that the federal government has a very, very light touch when it comes to elections. The states more or less occupy the field of elections, and that's more or less rendered in the Constitution. But you have 10,000 different jurisdictions. We have a very, very decentralized system. And that's not to say that things don't sometimes go wrong. I mean, it happens – it happened here in Maine in the last election. Up in Lincoln, they had a bomb threat at the school where they were having the polling station. And a relatively new clerk, they got everything, just picked everything up, and they moved it out to the parking lot, and they kept the election going. You know, so what we see is that having a decentralized system is actually very, very effective in helping to maintain and enhance the security of the system. And because Amy is in Bangor and I'm in Augusta, she didn't see me turn completely pale when she was talking about the nationalized system, because, you know, you put everything in one place, then it is easier to manipulate. And you can't really get into 503 town offices very easily without someone knowing what you're doing. And the tabulating machines, yeah, they are electronic, but the thumb drives are programmed one at a time, and they are mailed to the jurisdiction, so nothing's transmitted over the internet. So, you know, it gets down to some of the voter confidence issues, and, you know, that kind of gets into David's concern about how the legislature works. Well, that's why we elect legislators, you know, and we hold them accountable for their actions at the polling booth. So I think the system we have right now seems to work pretty well, and you know, the comments about the rarity of actual malevolent wrongdoing in the election, which is kind of a historic construct, as you know, has already been pointed out. But we have a pretty strong collective memory, and it kind of feeds into that, the whole voter fraud thing. Unfortunately, you go over the last 150 years, there are some fairly colorful episodes of election engineering, and the laws have been structured to prevent more of that. But, you know, before I was Secretary of State, I chaired the Fish and Wildlife Committee, and we dealt a lot with hunter safety. And I remember going through Freeport, and I met a woman walking her dog, and she was completely decked out in blaze orange and had a blaze orange vest and the dog. And I said, well, you know, you are in the middle of town. And she said, well, I'm not taking any chances. Now, when was the last time you heard about a hunting accident? It's been years. But the year that my parents moved to Maine, in 1954, we had 19 fatalities, over 100 serious incidents, and that was not uncommon. When I was a kid, you were truly crazy to go in the woods, and people haven't forgotten that. So even though we've cinched it down, there's still that collective concern. I think you see some of the same thing happening with elections as well.
David, thank you for your call. I want to go to a Facebook post. This is from Wynn. There seems to be an assumption that any voter fraud is of benefit of Democrats. I think he means Republicans. Trump claims – oh, I see. There seems to be an assumption that any voter fraud is benefit to Democrats. Trump claims it cost him the popular vote. It seems to me that fraud, if it exists to any extent, would work both ways and, in effect, would cancel out. Amy.
Well, what we see with the voter ID laws is that those, you know, to the extent that those exist, they would hurt often young people and people of color. So those are groups that would, you know, more likely support Democrats. And there are many incidents of, I mean, you can find of people acknowledging that who are people who are proponents of voter ID. If, you know, the New York Times put out this whole selection of them a couple of months ago of various elected officials, one in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, all saying these are Republican office holders or party officials who said that having voter ID would hurt Democrats and that's why they put them in. So that's, I think, where a lot of the idea that there'd be, you know, partisan effects come from, is that they really do seem to be intended to have a partisan impact. And, you know, really when we're talking about voting, we're talking about a core mechanism of democracy, and we want voters to be able to choose among the candidates to pick elected officials. We don't want elected officials to be able to choose who the voters are. And that applies whether we're talking about voter ID or we're talking about gerrymandering, you know, and many other kinds of situations.
Okay, we'll go to Michael calling from Brooklyn. If I, my clicker will work, there we go. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Everybody is very concerned about hacking during the election process, yet those same people are very afraid of tackling the problem at home with voter IDs. Hacking is something that you may never be able to fully control, but many states already have mechanisms in place for people to get either a driver's license or a citizenship ID. So why not start with the easy problems to solve first? Thank you.
Okay, Michael. Matt Dunlap, I know we've touched on this already. Why doesn't Maine have a voter ID? On some level, it makes sense.
It's a policy decision of the legislature, and it's debated every couple of years. In fact, when Secretary Charlie Summers was in office, there was a proposal for a photo ID for obtaining a ballot. And that was the same year that the discussion around Election Day registration erupted that Amy described earlier. And I think the voter ID bill got a little hot to handle politically, and so they sort of backed it off and into a resolve, and they created a commission to look at elections generally across the state, and that was chaired by former Judge John Atwood. And the Atwood Commission met around the state. They took a lot of testimony, and their conclusion, I think, surprised a lot of people, which was, given the chain of custody of our ballots now and the security of our systems at every single level, from the time a ballot leaves a printing press to when it's sealed in a ballot box, that the additional security that would be offered by a photo ID would not be worth the trouble to the citizens who would have to go through the machinations to get one. In other words, you would wind up disenfranchising people. And they recommended against a photo ID. And that's kind of where we've been since then. Now, this, no two states run their elections exactly the same way, and many states do have a photo ID requirement. And I know Democratic secretaries that advocate for it because it answers that question once and for all. I don't advocate for it because I'm also a motor vehicle administrator, and I know exactly what goes into building an ID, and it's not child's play. The rules are simple. The problem is going to be in the exceptions because you're always going to have somebody that was born on a farm. They've worked on that farm their whole life. They don't have a Social Security number, you know, and now they've got to travel somewhere. And how do you build an identity document around that? You're not going to do it at 7 o'clock on election night. And I think that's, you know, my concern as an elections official switching hats is that, you know, you don't have a right to drive, but you have a fundamental right to vote. And I think that's where we have to work backwards from. And that's what the legislature historically has done.
All right. Thank you, Michael, for your call here. I want to go up to you, David House, because I know that you are a scholar of the Voting Rights Act. And I want to ask, I understand that you are worried about the fate of the Voting Rights Act. What concerns you?
I think that one of the biggest challenges we see to the Voting Rights Act, and the Supreme Court showed some of this in its decision in 2013 in Shelby County versus Holder, which was a decision that basically destroyed one of the teeth or one of the big hooks that the Voting Rights Act had. So when it was drafted in 1964 and 5, the President Johnson wanted something that could really make it stick. And one of the concerns was that states might change their voter laws very frequently to keep one step ahead of the federal government's enforcement of voting practices. Well, the Shelby County versus Holder decision basically ruled a large chunk of the what was called pre-clearance clause of the Voting Rights Act, which meant that states needed to pre-clear changes in voting laws with the federal government to make sure that they weren't abridging or taking away the rights of people to vote in violation of the act. They had to pre-clear that with the federal government. That decision effectively destroyed part of it, and within a few hours, Texas had released already started on new voter laws that made stricter ID requirements. So what I see is that one of the pieces in recent articles and decisions, in fact, one of the articles written by a member of the same commission from Ohio, Ken Blackwell, he's co-author on it, He and his co-author in a recent article discussing what they call the other right to vote mentioned that the Voting Rights Act was written at a time that's far distant from the America we live in now. And while we can say that time has passed and some things have changed, I was thinking about that, especially in light of what we saw this weekend. And so if you're saying that are we living in a time where we see frequent demonstrations or unrest over racism, well, maybe not that frequent, but it certainly still exists. We certainly still see concerns about race and issues about disenfranchising people. And as long as we have that as a concern, I think something like the Voting Rights Act itself is still a necessary and important part of preserving that fundamental right to vote. And it deserves that attention. Now, obviously, I'm not on the Supreme Court, and that's what the court has ruled. But I think the act was written at a time where it was concerned about violence and racism, but at the same time, it was there to protect the fundamental right of people to vote and to get basically to preserve that right in the opposition of states that might have been trying to erase it through a variety of means. And intent was not necessarily something that had to be considered. So it doesn't mean that you have to intend to necessarily disenfranchise people. It's the fact that you have the effect of doing it. And I think that's something historically significant, and it's been an important part of our legacy since 1965.
Well, thank you. Matt Dunlap, you mentioned that the commission you serve on, the Presidential Commission, has had one meeting. When is your next meeting? What are you going to discuss?
Well, those are two very good questions, neither of which I have an answer to. This has been something that's been a little bit odd, is that you know, the commission was chartered in May under the executive order of the president, and then there was utter silence. You know, I had to fill out a bunch of paperwork, and people kept asking, when are you going to meet? And I didn't know. And then finally they said, well, we're shooting for sometime in the middle of July. We met on July 19th. At that meeting, we said, well, we're probably going to meet again sometime in the middle of September. But since that time, we have not heard where or when. So hopefully what we talk about are some of these issues that we've talked about today, you know, not only what the goals are of the commission, because we haven't really talked about our goals yet, but also what could the unintended consequences be. I mean, the whole issue of the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act that Dave was just talking about, you know, those present huge challenges to election officials, because even though Maine was not a Section 5 state, we watched what was happening with Section 5 in terms of the development of communities of interest when you're building a voter file or a districting plan. So now that that's gone, it kind of takes us into, you know, very unknown ground as we get into redistricting and the conduct of elections as well.
Well, thank you so much to all three of you. Matt Dunlap, Maine Secretary of State, Amy Freed, Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine. I skipped lines. Sorry, Amy. And David Howes, Associate Professor of History at Husson University. You guys don't need to switch jobs today. George Thomas ran the board today. We had additional help from John Bradford and Rich Tozier. Tomorrow on the program, debating the best television of all time. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.